Hello from Chicago. This is Physics 142 lecture for October 23rd, 2007, and I feel ridiculous talking to myself in my hotel room right now, but I hope that doesn't destroy the flow of the talk too much. At any rate, if you have not downloaded the PDF file that accompanies this audio file, you'll want to do that now. I'm starting on page 1. Let me know if you run into any technical difficulties in this with this technique of listening to the lectures. Also, email me with any questions you might have. I will assume that you've covered this material in the problem sets, the workshops, and future lectures. So I need to know if something didn't click for you. Presentation groups are now posted on the web. I want you to look at those and let me know if you have any problems. I want to proceed now to page 2 of the PDF file accompanying this lecture. Last time we talked a lot about relativity, and I introduce it at this point in the semester because the electric field and magnetic field transform relativistically, and they get mixed up when you go from one reference frame to another. I'm not going to really do that in detail because it's a little more complicated and then the simple Lorentz transformations that we've done so far. But I do like to do it sort of at this point to introduce the magnetic field. Einstein's 1905 paper on special relativity was entitled On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies because he was trying to understand problems that he saw with the concept of light and Maxwell's equations. In terms of looking at things from different points of view. Turns out 1905 was a fantastic year for Albert Einstein. He published this paper. He published a paper on the photoelectric effect, which launched quantum mechanics in my eyes in many ways. Planck had introduced quanta in the photon, basically, the quanta of light, in order to describe blackbody radiation. But people basically looked at Planck's work as amazing but fortuitous in that his idea that light might be in little packets was surely nonsense, because light was known to be a wave. But when Einstein was able to explain data on the photoelectric effect, basically light shining on a heavy metal and ejecting electrons, also assuming that light came in little packets, people began to take it very seriously. In fact, both of these ideas were really quite separate, and in both cases, energy of the packet was assumed to be proportional to the frequency, and the constant of proportionality was experimentally determined for both the photoelectric effect and the blackbody radiation to be the same, what we now call Planck's constant. And when you have a situation like that, you simply have to take it very seriously. And in my eyes, this sort of launched quantum mechanics. In another paper in 1905, Einstein explained Brownian motion, which is the jiggling of pollen or dust in a liquid when viewed through a microscope in a very steady environment. He interpreted it as, he was able to describe it as the statistic jiggling of what you would have from something that is being hit by atoms and molecules. So this was, in a sense, direct experimental evidence for the existence of atoms. And that also was a very important paper. So it's truly an amazing year for Einstein. At any rate, let's move on to slide 3. For slide 3, I'm reviewing a little bit what we did last time. Up at the top of slide 3, imagine having reference frame S, which is at rest with respect to U, and reference frame S prime, which is moving to the right with speed V. An event happens in the world around these two reference frames, and this event is described by the coordinates x, y, z, and time t in reference frame S and is described by coordinates x prime, y prime, z prime, t prime in reference frame S prime. The special theory of relativity tells us that the coordinates and time in the S frame can be transformed into the coordinates and time in the S prime frame through the Lorentz transformations, which are denoted in the upper right of slide 3. So we looked at that carefully last time. We also looked at the transformation of velocities. So if I have a reference frame S and a reference frame S prime moving at speed v with respect to S, if observers in both reference frames see some object moving with a velocity u, which is the velocity of the object in S, and we try to understand what the components of the velocity vector in S would look like to the observer in S prime, we derived last time the relativistic velocity transformations, which I show on the lower right. And these transformations are a bit more complex than what we see for the standard Lorentz transformations, and the reason for that is because the velocity, which is made up of a position and a time, both the position and the time transform and makes for a bit of a messy situation. Also notice the complication when you look at the on the lower right, when you look at the transverse components to the motion, that is the UY and UZ prime components, that on the right-hand side of those two expressions, you mix UY and UX, and on the bottom UZ and UX, because of the way we derive the transformations. Anyway, these are rather complex. If we now go to slide 4, we can define a different type of velocity, one which makes use of proper time, where proper time is the time as measured in the rest frame of the clock or some event. And we can define proper velocity, which I have denoted as eta in the second line on this slide, as dx over d proper time. And since dx, which is a differential length, transforms as gamma dx, because of length contraction, d tau is equal to 1 over gamma dt because of time dilation. And when I substitute in for 1 over gamma dt for d tau, we find that eta is equal to gamma times v. We have seen that in Lorentz transformations, the position x, y, z and the time get all mixed up during the Lorentz transformation. And in fact, we can form something like a vector of these four quantities. You're used to vectors with three quantities. We can form a four vector, which has four components instead of the three. And in this case, we call the space-time four vector, well, it's made up of the components x, y, z, and t. Similarly, we can form other four vectors of quantities that transform in relativity in the same way that the space-time four vector transforms. And energy and momentum happen to be one of these, where we have defined momentum, the relativistic momentum, as instead of m times v, m times eta, which is equivalent to m times gamma times v, and energy, which is the relativistic energy in the energy momentum four vector, is gamma times m times c squared. If we go to slide 5, this means since four vectors transform in the same way, on the left-hand side at the top of slide 5, we have the standard space-time transformation that you've seen. Then if we assume that momentum-energy four vector transforms in the same way, we would get a relationship between the x, y, z components of the momentum and the energy between the two coordinate systems, S and S prime. as shown in the upper right. Again, momentum and energy get sort of all mixed up as you do a transformation. Having defined relativistic energy the way that we have had to define it in order to have the energy momentum four vector transform properly, we can take the energy, which is equal to, as we've defined on slide 4 at the bottom, gamma mc squared, and do a Taylor series expansion of gamma, basically taking advantage of the fact that v is very small. And this is the origin of the famous equation E equals mc squared for objects that are not moving, where m is basically the rest mass. I tend not to like to use the words rest mass because mass turns out to be an invariant quantity as you transform from one reference frame to another. If you ever do any particle physics, you'll become intimately familiar with this. And so I tend to just like the word mass, but you often will hear it called rest mass. At any rate, that's a constant. So, if we now go to slide 6, what does all this have to do with electricity and magnetism? Well, we could talk about that at great length. Hold on a second, I want to get a sip of coffee. Okay, we could talk about that at great length. Here's one way to think about it. On the top half of slide 6, imagine if we had a metal wire, or some sort of wire which is made up of positive lattice points or nuclei, if you want, and then within that wire we have negative charges basically moving with a velocity u to the left. But in this case, let's say that the density of the charges, even though they're moving with a speed u, for the negative and the positive, the charge density is approximately the same. So what this means is that if I were to slice a small section along the wire, the number of positive and negative charges would be the same, and the net electric charge would be zero. Which means if I have outside of this wire a test positive test charge Q0, which I've put in yellow at pink point A, if it is sitting outside of the wire, there is no net electric field because there's no net field coming from the wire, so there's no force on this charge. Now, let's go to the bottom half of slide 6. And let's assume that we now jump in our trusty spaceship and we are moving to the right with a large velocity, which I'll call V, okay? And now, from our point of view, we would see the charges in the wire moving with two different velocities. One, which is U minus, which would be the charges, I mean, remember this is from our point of view, so we're zipping down the wire toward the right, which means if we were to look at the positive charges or the negative charges, they would all be moving to our left. But because the negative charges were moving with a velocity to our left already, the two sets of charges, negative and positive, will each be moving with different velocities from our point of view. Also, the test charge Q0 is going to be moving with a velocity which is the same U plus as the positive charge, because in the frame on the top half of slide 6, both the positive charges and Q0 were at rest. Well, we know that charge density is equal to the number of charges per unit length. And from our point of view, we're going to have Lorentz contraction of the length for both the positive charges and the negative charges. But because the velocity, the relative velocity of the positive charges and the negative charges with respect to us as we move as from our point of view, if we're standing still and we look at the relative velocity of the negative charges and the positive charges going to the left, they'll be different, which means the Lorentz contraction in the charge density expression, which is charge per unit length, is going to be different in the two cases, which means from this point of view, the linear charge density, lambda minus, and that for the negative charges, and that for the positive charges, lambda plus, they are different, which means we would now see a net electric charge on the wire, so that we could now say that the moving charge Q0, now moving in our frame of reference, will actually experience an electric force due to these perceived different charge densities. So in one reference frame we have no electric force, in the other reference frame we have an electric force. So all of a sudden this example is just meant to convey to you that things are not so simple when you look at electric fields in moving reference frames, inertial reference frames. Let's look at slide 7. In fact, if we look classically at what we talk about magnetic fields, those surround currents in wires. And if you put a compass near a wire, in fact, you can get, and you run current through the wire, you'll get a magnetic field which turns the compass. We also, as we'll see in a few minutes, a moving charge is affected by magnetic field. We have a moving charge in slide 6 at the bottom affected by this, by whatever's happening, this movement. And it's not even clear that it's not a magnetic field instead of an electric field. So it turns out that electric and magnetic fields do get all mixed up as you go through transformations from one reference frame to another. So having said all that, I'd like to introduce magnetism, and I haven't wasted a lot of breath trying to give you an intuitive feel for magnetism in the sense that you've all played with compasses and bar magnets, so I'm sure you have some sort of a feeling for a magnetic field. You may not have a great feeling for magnetic field lines yet, but we'll work on that. So I would like to introduce, I'm now on slide 7, the magnetic field, where we have referred to the electric field with a big letter E as a vector. We're going to describe the magnetic field in terms of big letter B. The units of the magnetic field, the MKS units, is the Tesla. In terms of the force, we have a new law, which we'll call the Lorentz force law, which states that the force on a charge is equal to Q times the electric field plus Q times the velocity of the charge crossed into the B field. So what we're doing by introducing the magnetic field is in the general situation where we have a charge which may or may not be moving, we have the second term. And if the charge is moving, then and you're in a magnetic field, then there will be a force on it described as the right-hand term on the Lorentz force law. So this is the general expression for the force on a charged particle moving with velocity v in a region of the electric field and magnetic field. Now, we have not done the cross product in this course before. I am hopeful that everyone in Physics 142 is pretty good with the cross product, but I'd like to give you a very short review because it is actually quite critical for this course from now on. In fact, at this stage, our course sort of goes three-dimensional, and the reason that we go three-dimensional in terms of what you're going to have to start visualizing really boils down to the fact that we have a cross product in the second term of the Lorentz force law in the middle of page 7. So let's go to page 8. I'd like to review cross product for you. In the general case where we have two vectors, A and B, then the cross product represents a vector which is at right angles to both A and B. And you can determine the direction for the cross product by using what we're going to call the right-hand rule. In the right-hand rule, you imagine holding your hand out as if you're about to shake hands with somebody, and you put your fingers along the direction of vector A in the A cross B. If we want to evaluate the direction of A cross B, hold on, because I didn't write that in the slide yet. Evaluate A cross B. So if we want to evaluate the direction of A cross B, we use the right-hand rule. You put your fingers along the direction of vector A, and then in the plane that contains both vector A and vector B, you rotate your fingers from A toward B in the direction of rotation which is in the direction of the smallest opening angle between vectors A and B, in the plane of A and B. And when you do this, your thumb will be pointing in the direction of the cross product A cross C. So if you look on slide 8 in the upper left, I have vectors A and B and vector C, and I've tried to indicate that vector C is at right angles to both A and B. This one is actually a little bit hard to visualize. When I drew it, my eyes saw it one way, but now if I look at it, you can see it multiple ways. So this is a little bit hard to see. A little bit easier to see what's happening on the upper right-hand corner. Imagine that I have vectors A and B in the plane of the screen as you're looking at it. Then, to evaluate the direction of the cross product C, you put your fingers along vector A in the plane, which is the plane of the screen as you see it, curl them in the direction of B, which is in the direction of the small opening angle between A and B. And your thumb is in the direction of C, which is indicated by the dot coming out of the screen. If we go to the lower left diagram, we have another example. If A is to the right in the screen and B is coming out at you, indicated by the dot, then if you put your fingers along A, curl them into B, your thumb should be going down in the direction of the cross product, which is C. In the case of the lower right-hand plot, if you have A to the right in the drawing, B is now going into the screen, and if you now put your fingers along A and curl them into B in the plane that contains the two, your thumb will be pointing upward, which is the direction of the cross product C. If you have any troubles at all visualizing this, you'll want to get over it. If we were in class, it'd be a little easier for me to show you this. You can look at the URL that I have at the bottom of slide 8, where there are little animated videos that show the right-hand rule in action and hopefully can clarify any confusion that you might have about the right-hand rule. Anything that involves magnetic fields involves things that go at right angles, and we're going to go three-dimensional, and you always have to get the direction right. So get real good at the right-hand rule if you're not already. Let's go to slide 9. In terms of evaluating the cross product, A cross B, remember that in vectors we have two types of multiplication. One is called the dot product, and one is called the cross product. The cross product is a little bit more complex. The dot product yields a scalar. In the cross product, it's a vector, and we have talked about the direction of it. The magnitude of the cross product is equal to the magnitude of each of the vectors multiplied by each other times the sine of the opening angle between them. If you want to evaluate this, it's substantially harder to evaluate in terms of its vector components than what you're used to from the dot product. In fact, the cross product is equal to the quantity on the right that I have outlined in a red line. Okay? And you'll note that it's a vector. You have an I hat, a J hat, and a K hat piece multiplied by lots of terms, each of which is sort of some combination of the components of A and B. You could just memorize this equation. Obviously, you can put it in your sheets or whatever, but if you want to know how to reproduce it with, you know, years hence, I mean, I'm ancient relative to you guys. It's been a long time since I learned this, but I have a way of knowing how to write down the cross section, not the cross section, I'm sorry, the cross product in terms of its components, and I do it by evaluating the determinant. So, if you go to the middle of page 9, let's say the section starting where I have the A in a circle, A cross B is equal to this strange thing, which is a determinant, where I have three rows in the determinant. The first one is I hat on the left-hand side, then J hat, then K hat. The second one represents is made up of the three different components of the A vector, and the third line is the three different components of the B vector. If you've never evaluated a determinant before, the way you evaluate it is to take the upper left-hand member, which is the I hat in this case, and you write it down, and then you multiply it by the combination of quantities. In this case, AY times BZ minus AZ times BY. And the way you remember what goes where is you look at the columns and rows that are not shared by the I-hat, and you do a little cross multiplication in the configuration of the little pink X with an arrow that I show running in the middle of AY, AZ, BY, BZ. For the second term, if you look beneath, if you look where I have written B in a circle, the second term you move over and get the J hat, and you do the same little cross multiplication pattern, except remember that you do not use the row or column members which share, you do not use components that share row or column with the J hat. In this case, you put in a minus sign in front of the J hat, and you just have to remember to do that. If you go to where I have drawn a pink C in a circle, you can see the pattern used to get the third term, which is the K hat, and then the little cross multiplication pattern using the components that do not share a row or column with the K hat. It's really pretty simple to do once you figure out how to do it, and because it's got a nice little pattern It's actually pretty easy to remember. Of course, for the purposes of this class, you will certainly have to evaluate the cross product once in a while, but I'm not big on memorization, so it isn't important to me that you actually know how to evaluate this determinant in this way, but I just show it to you because it's something that you'll find is useful through the years. Okay, so let's go to slide 10. The cross product is quite different from the dot product in that the cross product is a vector. The cross product magnitude is equal to the magnitude of one of the vectors in the cross product times the perpendicular component of the other vector. That is, times the component of the other vector which is perpendicular to the first vector. So if you look at the little drawing in the middle of the page where I have put a pink A circled, you can see vectors A and B in the plane of the drawing with an opening angle theta. The perpendicular component of B relative to A is denoted by the orange vector B perpendicular. And just from the trigonometry, we see that the magnitude of B perpendicular is equal to the magnitude of B times sine theta. So if I wanted to take the cross product, it will be the magnitude of A times B, the magnitude of B perpendicular, which is magnitude of B times sine theta. And if you go back up to the top of slide 9, you can see, in fact, this is the magnitude of the cross product is indeed equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times sine theta, where theta is the opening angle between them. So the magnetic part of the Lorentz force, which we know to be QV cross B, tells us that the force due to this piece is going to be at right angles to both the velocity and the magnetic field lines. So if we look on the lower left where I have put a pink B in a circle, if you have a case where a charged particle is moving along a magnetic field line or against a magnetic field line but parallel to it, the cross product is going to be zero because there's no perpendicular component of one vector with respect to the other. In this case, the magnetic force is going to be zero. And this is always a good thing to keep in mind. In magnetic problems, what is useful in a three-dimensional problem is to know the component of the velocity that is parallel to the magnetic field and the component of the velocity that is perpendicular to the magnetic field. When you know this, you can calculate the force in those two orthogonal directions. It's zero in one case, and you can calculate it in the other case, and then use your whatever you need to use to solve the problem, your basic kinematic expressions. Let's go to slide 11. In slide 11, I picture on the upper right a region of uniform magnetic field, B. And in this case, I represent the magnetic field by the green lattice dots. The magnetic field is coming out of the board toward your face, coming out of the screen. Okay? In this case, if we have an electric charge, an electron, which has a negative charge moving in the direction indicated by the blue vector V, then if you use the right-hand rule on this particular charge, the way that I do it, because it's negative, then the right-hand rule is defined for in QV cross B, it's defined for a positive charge for the right-hand rule. So if you want to know what happens to the negative charge, the electron, it's V cross B, so I put my fingers along V, I curl them up toward B, and that puts my thumb out of the circle, the pink circle as I have it drawn. But because it's a negative charge rather than a positive charge, I flip my thumb around, and I know that the force due to the magnetic field on the moving electron is going to be in toward the center of this pink circle. In a uniform magnetic field, a moving charge, in fact, will execute a circular motion, where the centripetal force will be as written, where I have pink A in a circle. The centripetal force is equal to mv squared over r, where v is the tangential velocity and r is the radius of the circle. This force is going to be equal to qvb, where, again, v is the magnitude of the velocity perpendicular to the magnetic field. I can solve for the radius of the circle, which is mv over qb. So you can confine charged particles in a region of magnetic fields using you can confine charged particles in small regions using magnetic fields. You can also just manipulate their path by using magnets. I have a very fun, I don't have a demo for you this week because it's hard for me to really do that in this format of a lecture. But I do have a very cute Java applet that I commissioned Truth and Beauty Software to write to do for me. In this demo, you can get to it by going to the class website and scroll down until you find where I have Java applets listed, and look at the one that's entitled Magnetic Fields. In this little Java applet, you have a cannon which shoots charged particles at different angles and different velocities into a region of uniform magnetic field of varying strengths. And it's fun to shoot these little charged particles and look at the motion in the magnetic field. I strongly urge you to play with this for a little while. Before you quit, what I'd like you to try to do at some point after you play with it a bit is to start out with a weak magnetic field, shoot a particle into the magnetic field, and then turn the magnetic field strength up very quickly and trap the particle and have it execute circular motion. You also can flip the sign of the magnetic field as the charged particle is moving through it and watch it execute sort of a figure S pattern. So, fun with computer Java applets. Okay, so I hope you will play with that and get a feeling for charged particles, charged particle trajectories and magnetic fields. If we go to slide 12, there are lots of people in this world who do lots of things with charged particle trajectories in magnetic fields. In fact, the way you can, the problem with accelerating charged particles is that it becomes very expensive to build a device that has a continual accelerating gradient. So what happens, so one way around that is to build one region where you accelerate a particle and then accelerate the particle through it and then use a magnetic field to bring it back around and accelerate it through that region again. So an early type of accelerator was known as a cyclotron. And in a cyclotron, you have what are known as magnet Ds. I have two magnets, sort of in the shape of a D, situated as in the region in the drawing where I have an A in a circle. So each of these magnets represents a region of a uniform magnetic field. There's a gap between the magnets, and within that gap, there's a strong electric field because I have charge on one side positive and on the other side negative. So what you can do is start out with charged particle starting out at point B, basically in the middle of the two D's, and let's say that it starts out with positive charge, and it's accelerated toward the negative charge on the other magnet, and then it enters the region of the magnetic field, and it executes circular motion and goes back the other way. If I know the timing well and can alternate the charge on the two D's, by the time the charge that I'm accelerating comes back around to go back through the gap, I've flipped the sign of the charge between the two D's so that it's accelerated through the gap again. And then it turns in a circle as it goes through the top magnet, comes back around. I flip the charge again. When it goes through the gap, it gets accelerated again through the electric field. And you'll note that it spirals outward. It spirals outward because the velocity is changing. So if you look back up at slide 11, you see that the radius goes as mass times velocity over QB. B is uniform in this case in the magnets. The charge hasn't changed, but and the mass doesn't change, but the velocity changes, so the radius gets bigger and bigger as the particle moves out, and eventually it escapes one of the magnets, and we have an accelerated beam. This is the idea for a cyclotron. There's another type of accelerator, which is known as a synchrotron, which is more conventional for the types of accelerators built in today's world. This is a typical relativistic heavy ion collider is a synchrotron. The Fermilab Tevatron is a synchrotron. And in this game, you build something which is known as an RF cavity, which is basically a radio frequency cavity where what you have is a standing radio wave or microwave in a cavity. It's very similar to standing waves on strings, but in this case it's an electromagnetic wave. Now, we haven't really talked about electromagnetic waves yet, but basically light or radio waves, whatever, are a combination of oscillating electric and magnetic waves, as we'll see when we get to Maxwell's equations. And you can create a situation where you have a wave that's like a standing wave on a string, except it's an electric field that's oscillating back and forth. And in this case, you arrange it so that the electric field is oscillating in the direction that you want the particle to be accelerated as it goes around the ring. And in this case, every time a charged particle goes around the circle, it gets kicked by the electric field in the RF cavity. And at the same time, you increase the magnetic field around the beam pipe so that the particle stays on a circle even though its velocity is increasing. So in this case, for the synchrotron, if we go back up to the equation in the middle of slide 11, which is referred to by the pink B in a circle, the radius is equal to mv over qb. In this case, v is changing, but you also change b as you add energy to the particle, so that you hold the radius constant, which means you only have to dig one tunnel or have one beam pipe, and you can continue to use the same accelerating piece, the RF cavity, every time the particle goes around. Of course, you have to, you call it a synchrotron because you have to have everything in sync with the circulation frequency of the beam, so that every time it comes around, you're kicking it in the right direction. The red X's in the little diagram of the synchrotron I have on slide 12, excuse me, represent magnets around the ring holding the particle in a circle. So if we go now to slide 12, oh, that was 12, sorry. Go now to slide 13. Another place where we will run into moving charges, of course, are currents in wires. And in the drawing that I have in the upper part of slide 13, I have exactly that, a current I moving through a wire. And let's assume that I have some wire, which basically is a length L in a magnetic field, a uniform magnetic field, which is represented by the black X's, going down into the screen. Because we have current in the wire, which are moving charges, and we have it in a magnetic field, and there is a perpendicular component of the velocity with respect to the magnetic field direction, we expect to see a magnetic force on the wire. I want you to always remember that in these problems, the I, the current direction, that is, the velocity that is assumed in QV cross B, is the direction for positive current, positive charge current flow. So if you have a problem where there are negative charges moving, remember you'll have to use the right-hand rule and flip direction. At any rate, if we want to understand the force on the wire, then we know that each charge is going to have a force on it, which is Q times the drift velocity of the charge cross B. And we're going to have to multiply this individual charge's force by something that represents the number of charges moving in the segment of wire, which would be the number of charges per unit volume that I've signified as little n in the equation given by or shown by the pink A in a circle. So we have the QV cross B times the number of charges per unit volume times the cross-sectional area of the wire times the length of wire that we have in the magnetic field. So A times L represents the volume of the wire. N is the charges per unit volume. So together you have the number of total charges multiplied by the force on each unit charge, which is the QV cross B. The current itself, if you go to the little equation where I have the circle, the B in a circle, the current itself is going to be the number of charges per unit volume times the charge times the drift velocity times the cross-sectional area. And if you look at the units, this works out. So if I take I equal to NQ drift velocity times A, I can substitute the current in for those pieces in the equation denoted by A and get the equation denoted by the C in a pink circle down at the bottom. The force on the wire will be the length of the wire in the magnetic field times I vector cross B, where I vector basically is something which is the magnitude of the current with a direction that's in the direction of positive current flow. Sometimes it's easier to think of it in terms of the magnitude of the current times L vector cross B, where L vector really represents the length that's in the magnetic field with a direction that is given by the direction of the current. So sometimes you'll see this force on a wire written as L times I vector cross B vector. Sometimes you'll see it as I times L vector cross B vector. Again, this is really in the spirit of trying to make things as complicated as possible to preserve jobs for you for the future. So we do this all for you. Okay, let's now go to slide 14. So we can do all sorts of problems with arbitrary degrees of nastiness using this simple formula with currents carried in wires. If we look at the drawing I have in the sort of upper to middle left of this page 14, what I have is a blue current loop where it is shaped like a rectangle, and it is hinged so that it can rotate about the y-axis. And we have a current flowing, a current I, which is flowing in the direction of the little arrows on the rectangular blue loop that I have in the drawing. This is in a magnetic field B, which is uniform, filling the volume where the current loop happens to be, and is headed in the positive x direction. The question is, if I have this current loop in the magnetic field with current I, what is the torque about the y-axis? If you have forgotten what torque is, you probably want to go and review that in your mechanics class, mechanics notes, because there are lots of problems with torque when it comes to magnetic fields. At any rate, let us assume that the rectangular is 5 centimeters by 10 centimeters, as I have denoted in the drawing. And it has 4 sides, these rectangles, this rectangle does, which I've labeled A, B, C, and D, the little pink A, B, C, and D in circles. If we look at this situation from the top, if we basically are looking at it such that the y-axis goes through our eyeball, then we see, we basically look at a projection into the XZ plane of this situation. And what you see is a radius R, which is going to be 5 centimeters. Think of it as the side of the rectangle, which is D, looking at it. That has an opening angle with the x-axis, theta. And if you want to understand the torque, you have to understand what is the net force that's rotating this beast around the y-axis. And to see this a little bit better, perhaps you want to look at the drawing that I have on the lower right, where we see our rectangle, and we can consider each of the sides of the rectangle as individual line segments. The torque caused by the magnetic field on side A is going to be zero because the lever arm with respect to the axis of rotation is zero, so there'll be no torque contribution from side A. For sides D and B, if you do the right-hand rule, put your fingers along the direction of the current flow, and evaluate the direction of the force by curling in, by doing the cross product into B, you'll find that the force on side D is up and the force on side B is down. And because of the symmetry of this problem in the rectangle, the net force on the loop itself is going to be zero. That leaves us with the force on side C, which if you evaluate the direction of it, that force will be directly out toward you. And this force will now have a component which can rotate the loop. And you can see the component on the drawing on the upper right. You can see the pink F, the pink force, represents the net force on side C, and the component of it which can rotate the current loop is F cosine theta. So the torque is going to be the lever arm times F cosine theta. So the lever arm is the distance R, or 5 centimeters, times F cosine theta. F is going to be I times L times B, the current, times the length in the magnetic field, which is 10 centimeters, times the magnitude of the magnetic field, so it's ILB. And the direction of the torque is going to be down if you use the right-hand rule that you learned when you discussed torques. So this is a typical type of wire in a magnetic field problem. This is also quite important if you want to understand the interaction of particle spins in magnetic fields, like nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. And the reason for this is that you can think of spin of a charged particle, the spin quantum number, Basically, the way to think about it is you could imagine each charged particle, like an electron or a proton or something, to be a small ball of uniform charge which is spinning. And as it's spinning, it will basically be a current loop. And if you have a magnetic field, you can have a torque on a current loop, and this can cause classical spin flips. Something to think about as we go along. So that is slide 14. Let's move on to slide 15. You don't always have to have currents flowing in a wire. Often it's the motion of the charged particles. We've mentioned some already, accelerators. Another type of instrument that's very useful is known as a mass spectrometer. If you you might, again, if you didn't, you want to go look at the magnetic fields Java applet on the class website, again, the one with the cannon, to get a feeling. This is the magnetic spectrometer. A mass spectrometer is very similar to what you see in that Java applet. In this case, down where we have the A in a pink circle, we have what is a charged particle source. Basically, you put a sample of some chemical crud that you want to analyze into some sort of vessel, which you heat up. And when you heat it up, you'll form charged particles by destroying whatever chemical crud it is that you're wanting to analyze. And you can then accelerate these particles through a potential difference, which I denote by large V. And because you're now accelerating these particles through a potential difference, they will gain a velocity, and then they enter a region of a uniform magnetic field where they will undergo circular motion, as we saw earlier. And basically, you can get an expression for the charge-to-mass ratio, which depends on where the radius depends on the charge-to-mass ratio. So the kinetic energy, which is equal to whatever the charge of the species is times E times the potential, is equal to 1/2 mv squared, down at the bottom by definition of what we mean by potential and kinetic energy. And if we go to slide 16, you can solve for the velocity of the particle as it enters the field, and then we can find, for example, for a given radius, what the mass of the particle is that will hit, that will have a certain radius circle going through the mass spectrometer. So this would be slide 16. Or you can, continues on slide 16. Basically, what happens as you look at slide 15 in the drawing, the bigger the circle, the further, the bigger the diameter of the circle, which I've denoted with the red X at the bottom of the magnetic field region. If we place a detector where the particles hit, you can actually count how many particles hit at different radii, basically. And if you look at the expression denoted with the pink A on slide 16, you can see an expression where the mass of whatever hits at position X is equal to the charge times B squared over 8 times the potential. If I pull Q down underneath M, I can basically solve for the mass to charge ratio is equal to a constant times X squared. So in other words, once I decompose my chemical crud and I accelerate it with a given potential into the magnetic field region, where it hits on the detector is entirely specified by the mass to charge ratio. So what you can get out of a mass spectrometer is you can destroy an organic compound, for example, and then determine what the mass to charge ratio is for all of the fragments that are created by that particular compound when it's destroyed. And it turns out that in much the same way as you can create that you can use a fingerprint to ID a person, you can take specific organic compounds or other compounds and decompose them, and they will decompose into usually a particular set of fragments and a particular set of charge to mass ratios. And by looking at the relative proportion of these fragments, you can get something that is useful for identifying what the compound was that got destroyed. So if you've taken chemistry, you may have actually used a mass spectrometer. If you haven't, it's an example of an extremely valuable and important diagnostic tool that is used in chemistry and biology for analytical chemistry work that is entirely based in physics, as most of chemistry is, but I didn't say that. Okay, so I think I've now been talking for about an hour. I'm going to stop this particular lecture. I've gotten as far as I wanted to get for this particular lecture, and I think I actually cover more material using this format than I do if I'm in the classroom. So if you'll allow me to stop here, we will pick up here for the lecture that I'll provide for you on Thursday or before. So have a good day.